A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. His son Ezra is 11 months old, and he's asking what's actually going on inside that little head. What does the world look, sound, and feel like to an 11-month-old? How do they understand who their parents are versus other people? And when teething pain or a first fever hits, what can parents do beyond medication to actually ease the distress? It's a great question, because at this age, you've got this perfect storm. Object permanence is settling in, stranger anxiety is peaking, and the body is going through physical misery. The baby can't localize or explain. So where do we even start?
Let's start with what they actually see, because I think most parents assume their 11-month-old sees the world the way they do, and that's just not true. At 11 months, visual acuity is somewhere between 20/40 and 20/60. So, if you're standing across the room, your baby sees you clearly enough to recognize your face, but the fine details, the expression in your eyes, the subtle micro-movements of your mouth, those are still blurry. They're getting the broad strokes of your face, not the high-definition version.
Which explains why they can spot you from across a room, but also why they sometimes stare at you like they're trying to process whether it's actually you.
And here's what's fascinating. Depth perception at 11 months is mature enough for crawling, but not for judging drop-offs. There's this classic experiment from Eleanor Gibson in 1960, the visual cliff. You take a glass surface with a checkerboard pattern underneath, and on one side, the pattern is right under the glass, on the other side, it's dropped several feet down, creating the illusion of a cliff. Babies who are crawling age, so around 7 to 11 months, will happily crawl across the shallow side but hesitate at the deep side, even though the glass is perfectly solid. Recent replications show 11-month-olds still show that hesitation. Their visual system can detect a depth difference, but their motor planning hasn't caught up. They perceive the drop-off as a threat, even though they've never fallen off anything like it.
Their brain is saying, that looks wrong, but they don't have the life experience to override it. Which, now that you mention it, is basically the entire first year of life.
It really is. And hearing is another domain where parents get surprised. At 11 months, hearing acuity is fully mature. They can hear as well as you can in terms of detecting sounds. But auditory filtering is not. The cocktail party effect, your ability to focus on one voice in a noisy room and tune out everything else, doesn't develop until age 3 or 4, so your 11-month-old hears everything equally. The blender, the door slam, the sibling shouting, the dog barking, your voice. It's all coming in at the same volume, same priority.
Which is why a sudden loud noise can trigger what looks like a completely disproportionate meltdown. It's not that they're being dramatic, it's that their auditory system just got flooded with no way to filter it.
And that's actually a good segue into something that I think is the most underappreciated aspect of infant experience, interoception and proprioception. Proprioception is your sense of where your body is in space. Interoception is your sense of your internal body states, hunger, thirst, pain, temperature. At 11 months, both of these systems are still being wired up. The insular cortex, which is the brain region that maps internal body states, is still developing. This has huge implications for how a baby experiences pain, especially teething pain.
Okay, this is the part where I need you to unpack that. Because every parent has watched their baby scream with teething pain and wish they could just ask, where does it hurt? Why can't the baby localize it?
Because the brain's internal map of the mouth and jaw isn't detailed enough yet. Pain signals from the gums travel up through the trigeminal nerve to the brainstem and then to the thalamus and insular cortex. But at 11 months, the insular cortex doesn't have the fine-grained somatotopic mapping that adults have. So the pain is experienced as a diffuse, poorly localized ache that radiates through the entire jaw, sometimes into the ear, sometimes into the cheek. The baby doesn't know it's specifically the lower left molar. They just know everything from the chin to the ear feels wrong.
It's not just my gum hurts. It's my entire head is experiencing something awful, and I don't know where it starts or ends.
And this is why you'll see babies pulling at their ears when they're teething. Parents often think ear infection, but it's actually referred pain. The sensory nerves from the gums and the ear share pathways, and the baby's brain can't distinguish the source.
That's genuinely useful to know, because the pediatrician is going to check for an ear infection anyway. But if it's 3 in the morning and the baby is pulling at his ear and you've got a fever spike, knowing that teething can cause referred ear pain might save you an emergency room trip.
On the fever point, this is probably the single biggest misconception I want to address. Teething does not cause true fever. This is something I see repeated constantly in parenting forums. Teething can cause a very slight elevation in temperature, up to about 100.4 Fahrenheit or 38 Celsius, because of localized inflammation in the gums. The cytokines that drive that local inflammation can enter the bloodstream in tiny amounts, but a true fever, something over 100.4, is almost always from an infection. The teething and the fever happen at the same time because this is the age when maternal antibodies are waning, and babies are putting everything in their mouths, so they're catching every virus in the neighborhood.
If your baby has a fever of 101, don't tell yourself it's just teething. That's a coincidence, not causation.
Now let's talk about what a fever actually feels like to an 11-month-old, because it's not just, I feel hot. The febrile response is mediated by cytokines, specifically interleukin-1 and interleukin-6. These cross the blood-brain barrier and act on the hypothalamus, which is the body's thermostat. The hypothalamus raises the set point, and suddenly the body thinks its normal temperature should be higher. So the baby feels cold, not hot, which is why they shiver. At the same time, those cytokines trigger systemic malaise, muscle aches, fatigue, nausea. The baby can't say, I feel achy all over. They just feel globally terrible.
Their thermoregulation is less efficient than an adult's, right? They overheat faster and cool down slower.
Which is why tepid sponging. The old-school advice to sponge a feverish baby with lukewarm water is now recommended against by the American Academy of Pediatrics. It can cause shivering, and shivering generates heat, which actually raises core temperature. You're making the fever worse while making the baby more uncomfortable. The AAP's position is clear. Tepid sponging is not recommended for fever management.
What does work? You mentioned skin-to-skin contact earlier.
Skin-to-skin contact at room temperature, not cold, activates something called C-tactile afferents. These are specialized nerve fibers in the skin that respond specifically to gentle, slow-stroking touch. They're fully functional by 6 months of age, and when stimulated, they send signals directly to the insular cortex and the posterior superior temporal sulcus, regions involved in social bonding and emotional processing. This activates the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the body's calming system. Cortisol drops, oxytocin rises, heart rate slows.
Holding your feverish baby against your chest isn't just comforting in a vague emotional sense. There's a specific neurobiological pathway that's being activated.
And it's more effective for comfort than tepid sponging, which can trigger a stress response. The research on this is solid. A 2017 study in Kura Biology confirmed that C-tactile afferents are fully developed and functional by 6 months, and gentle touch activates them in a way that produces measurable reductions in cortisol.
Let's shift to the social cognition side, because this is where 11 months gets really interesting. Why does a baby who was fine with grandma last week suddenly scream when she walks in the room?
This is the stranger anxiety peak, and I want to reframe what's actually happening here. Most people think of it as fear. The baby is scared of strangers. But the neuroscience suggests it's more of a predictive processing error. By 6 to 8 months, the fusiform face area in the temporal lobe has become specialized for familiar faces. The baby's brain has built a predictive model. When I'm in my living room, I expect to see mom's face, dad's face, maybe a sibling's face. When grandma walks in, even though she's familiar, her face in that context violates the prediction.
It's not grandma is scary. It's grandma is unexpected.
The amygdala, which is involved in detecting salient or unexpected stimuli, fires off a mismatch signal. This signal feels unpleasant, not because the stimulus is threatening, but because it violates the brain's predictive model. The baby experiences this as distress. And here's the nuance. The same baby might be perfectly fine with a complete stranger if the context is predictable. The mail carrier appearing at the front door? That's a known event. The mail carrier appears. The door closes. The mail carrier leaves. No prediction violated.
The intervention isn't avoid all strangers. It's introduce new people in familiar contexts and let the baby control the pace of interaction.
Let the baby be on your lap. Let them observe the new person from the safety of your arms. Let them approach when they're ready. Don't hand them over to someone they're unsure about. That's a massive prediction violation, and it teaches the baby that their distress signals don't produce a protective response.
Which brings us to something I've been thinking about, the still face effect. You mentioned earlier that when parents are stressed by the baby's distress, their facial affect flattens. What's the mechanism there?
The still face paradigm is one of the most robust findings in developmental psychology. If a parent interacts normally with their baby, smiling, cooing, responsive facial expressions, and then suddenly goes still and expressionless, the baby detects this within seconds. Their heart rate goes up, they become agitated, they try to re-engage the parent, and when that fails, they withdraw. At 11 months, babies are exquisitely sensitive to facial effect. They're reading your face constantly to calibrate their own emotional state.
If your baby is crying from teething pain at 3 in the morning, and you pick them up but your face is tense and exhausted and flat, the baby detects that as a threat signal. And now you've got a feedback loop. Baby cries, parent tenses, baby detects tension, baby cries harder, parent tenses more.
That's the loop. And breaking it requires what researchers call exaggerated affect. Big, warm facial expressions even when you're exhausted. A sing-song voice even when you're running on fumes. Rhythmic movement. Rocking, swaying, bouncing. These are all signals to the baby's limbic system that says the environment is safe, the caregiver is present, the threat is manageable.
You're essentially performing calmness to activate the baby's calming systems.
And I know that sounds exhausting, because it is. But understanding the mechanism helps. You're not being fake. You're deliberately activating a neurobiological pathway that your baby cannot activate on their own yet. Their prefrontal cortex isn't mature enough for emotional self-regulation. They borrow your nervous system to regulate theirs.
That's a really beautiful way to put it. They borrow your nervous system.
It's literally what's happening. The vagus nerve, which is the main parasympathetic pathway from the brain to the body, is myelinated but not fully integrated with the prefrontal control systems at this age. So the baby can't consciously calm themselves down. But social engagement, eye contact, soothing voice, gentle touch, activates the ventral vagal complex, which slows the heart and reduces the stress response. The parent is essentially serving as an external regulator.
Let's talk about sleep, because this is where all of these systems collide. Teething pain, fever, stranger anxiety, auditory sensitivity, and they all hit the sleep architecture at once.
Sleep at 11 months is still very different from adult sleep. REM sleep accounts for about 40% of total sleep compared to about 20% in adults, and sleep cycles are 50 to 60 minutes compared to 90 minutes in adults. So every hour or so, the baby transitions between sleep stages, and during that transition, they're in a very light sleep. If there's teething pain, or if they're febrile, or if there's a sudden noise, that's when they wake up.
Parents interpret this as, my baby is a bad sleeper, or something is wrong.
When in reality, this is normal sleep architecture for this age, and it's actually protective during illness. Frequent waking allows the baby to check their environment. Is my caregiver still here? Am I safe? And it allows for temperature regulation. A baby who sleeps too deeply during a fever could overheat dangerously. The frequent waking is a feature, not a bug.
That's a reframe that I think a lot of exhausted parents need to hear. The waking isn't a failure of your sleep training. It's your baby's brain doing exactly what it evolved to do.
The practical implication is, don't fight it. Instead, optimize the sleep environment. Cool room, 68 to 72 Fahrenheit. Minimal clothing so they can dissipate heat. White noise to mask sudden sounds that might trigger a startle response during light sleep. A consistent bedtime routine that signals to the circadian system that sleep is coming.
What about the order of interventions when the baby wakes with teething pain? You mentioned earlier there's a sequence that works better than just reaching for the medicine cabinet.
The gate control theory of pain is the framework here. Pain signals travel up from the gums through small diameter nerve fibers to the spinal cord, where they have to pass through a kind of neurological gate before they reach the brain. Cold sensation travels on large diameter fibers, and when those large fibers are activated, they can actually close the gate to pain signals at the spinal level. So if you offer a cold teether first, refrigerated, not frozen, because frozen can cause tissue damage, you're activating those large fibers and gating the pain before the baby's suck reflex kicks in.
The protocol is cold teether first, wait 5 minutes, then offer a feed.
The cold stimulus gates the pain. Then the feeding provides comfort and nutrition without the baby associating sucking with pain, which can happen if you feed them while their gums are throbbing. And the cold washcloth is particularly effective because it combines cold with proprioceptive input. The pressure of chewing gives the brain information about where the jaw is in space, which helps modulate pain through the descending pain inhibitory pathway.
The descending pain inhibitory pathway. That's the brain's own painkiller system, right?
The periaqueductal gray in the midbrain sends signals down to the spinal cord that suppress pain transmission. Chewing, rhythmic movement, sucking, all of these activate that system. So when you give a baby a cold washcloth to chew on, you're doing two things at once, gating pain at the spinal level with cold and activating the brain's endogenous pain suppression with proprioceptive input.
Neither of those mechanisms involves medication. So you're not replacing ibuprofen. You're doing something that ibuprofen can't do, which is activate the body's own pain modulation systems.
Medication reduces inflammation and blocks pain signals at the chemical level. These sensory interventions work at the neural circuit level. They're complementary, not alternative.
Let's circle back to the social and emotional piece, because I think there's a dimension here that parents often miss. At 11 months, the baby is in this unique window where they're becoming intensely attached to their primary caregivers while simultaneously becoming aware that those caregivers can leave. Object permanence has kicked in. They know you exist when you're not in the room, but they don't have the cognitive capacity to understand that you'll come back.
This is the separation anxiety peak, and it's cognitively driven. Before about 8 months, out of sight is literally out of mind. The parent leaves the room, the parent ceases to exist. At 11 months, the parent leaves the room and the baby knows the parent still exists somewhere, but has no way to predict when or if they'll return. That's a much more distressing experience.
The distress of separation is actually a sign of cognitive progress. The baby is smart enough to know you're out there, but not smart enough to know you're coming back.
This is where the parent's departure routine matters enormously. If you disappear suddenly, sneaking out while the baby is distracted, you're creating an unpredictable world. The baby learns that the parent can vanish at any moment, which increases vigilance and clinginess. If you create a consistent departure ritual, a specific phrase, a specific wave, a specific sequence, the baby's predictive brain learns that this sequence means departure, and departure is always followed by return.
The ritual isn't just cute. It's scaffolding the baby's ability to predict, and therefore tolerate separation.
And this connects to something deeper about how 11-month-olds understand other people. They're beginning to develop what psychologists call social referencing. They look at your face to figure out how to react to an ambiguous situation. If a stranger approaches, the baby looks at you. If your face says this is safe, the baby is less distressed. If your face says I'm anxious, the baby's threat response amplifies.
Which puts a lot of pressure on the parent to be aware of their own facial expressions.
And I think this is where the still face feedback loop becomes especially relevant in the context of illness. When your baby has a fever and you're worried because fevers are scary for parents, your face is showing that worry. The baby sees worry on your face and interprets it as confirmation that something is very wrong. So one of the most powerful interventions a parent can do during illness is to consciously soften their facial expression, even while they're monitoring the temperature and checking for concerning symptoms.
You're not denying the reality of the situation. You're managing the baby's interpretation of the situation.
The baby doesn't need you to be calm. They can't tell the difference between genuine calm and performed calm. They just need the sensory input of a calm face, a calm voice, calm touch. If you can provide that while also doing everything you need to do medically, you're giving the baby the best of both worlds.
Let's talk about some specific non-pharmacological interventions for teething, because I think parents want a toolkit beyond give them something cold to chew on. What's actually happening at the receptor level?
The key receptor here is TRPM8. That's transient receptor potential mellistatin. 8. It's a cold-sensitive ion channel expressed in sensory neurons in the oral mucosa. When you apply something cool, not frozen, to the gums, TRPM8 channels open, sodium and calcium ions flow in, and the neuron fires, sending a cooling signal to the brain. This cooling signal competes with the pain signal at the spinal trigeminal nucleus, which is the first relay station for sensory input from the face and mouth. That's the gate control mechanism in action.
The difference between refrigerated and frozen?
A frozen teether can be below 32 degrees Fahrenheit. That's cold enough to cause vasoconstriction in the gum tissue, which reduces blood flow and can actually cause tissue damage if held against the gums for too long. It also activates cold pain receptors, a different set of neurons that signal painful cold rather than pleasant cool. A refrigerated teether, around 40 to 45 degrees, activates TRPM8 without triggering cold pain receptors. It's cool enough to gate the pain without causing additional discomfort.
The sweet spot is refrigerator temperature, not freezer temperature.
And a cold washcloth works particularly well because you can control the temperature precisely, and the texture provides that proprioceptive input we talked about.
What about amber teething necklaces? I feel like we should address those.
I'm going to be direct here. There is no evidence that amber teething necklaces do anything for pain. The claim is that body heat releases succinic acid from the amber, which is absorbed through the skin and acts as an analgesic. Succinic acid is a real compound. It's involved in the Krebs cycle, but there's no mechanism by which it would be released from amber at body temperature in meaningful amounts, absorbed through the skin, and have an analgesic effect. And more importantly, these necklaces are a strangulation and choking hazard. The American Academy of Pediatrics explicitly warns against them.
They're the homeopathic remedy of the teething world. Theoretically elegant, empirically empty, and physically dangerous.
That's a fair summary. Stick with cold, pressure, and rhythmic movement. Those have actual mechanisms behind them.
Let's shift to the fever piece, because I want to get into what parents can do beyond medication when their baby is febrile and miserable. You mentioned skin to skin.
Hydration is critical, and the way you offer it matters. A febrile baby is losing fluid through increased respiration and sweating, but they may refuse to nurse or take a bottle because sucking is effortful when they feel terrible. Offering small amounts frequently, a few milliliters every 10 to 15 minutes, is often more successful than trying to get them to take a full feed, and the temperature of the fluid matters. Room temperature, or slightly cool liquids, are more palatable to a febrile baby than warm liquids.
Because their internal thermostat is already set too high.
And cool liquids can provide a small amount of conductive cooling to the core, though the effect is modest. The main benefit is that they're more likely to drink them.
What about clothing and environment?
The instinct is to bundle up a sick baby, especially if they're shivering. But shivering is the body's way of generating heat to reach the new, higher set point. If you bundle them, you're helping them reach that higher temperature faster. The current recommendation is light clothing, a cool room, and a light blanket if they're shivering. You want to allow heat dissipation without causing discomfort from the shivering.
The old wives' tale about sweating out a fever is exactly backwards.
Sweating is what happens when the fever breaks, when the hypothalamus resets the set point back to normal and the body dumps heat to cool down. You can't force that process by piling on blankets. You just make the baby more uncomfortable and potentially drive the fever higher.
There's something I want to touch on that I think gets overlooked in discussions about infant distress, the parent's own nervous system. You mentioned the feedback loop earlier, but I think there's a deeper point here about how a parent's anterior cingulate cortex is essentially hardwired to find their own infant's cry physically unbearable.
That's right. The anterior cingulate cortex is involved in error detection and emotional salience. When a parent hears their own baby cry, the ACC lights up in a way that it doesn't for other babies' cries. It's not just annoying, it's physiologically activating. Heart rate goes up, blood pressure goes up, cortisol spikes. Evolution has designed parents to be unable to ignore their own baby's distress signals.
Which is adaptive. But it also means that when your baby has been crying for 2 hours from teething pain, and you've tried everything, and you're exhausted, and your ACC is screaming at you, that something is terribly wrong. That's when parents make poor decisions. They reach for interventions that might not be safe, or they get frustrated, or they just shut down emotionally.
This is where having a protocol really helps. if you know in advance what the sequence of interventions is. Cold teether, wait 5 minutes, offer feed, if still distressed, try skin to skin with exaggerated affect. If still distressed, consider medication. You don't have to think creatively at 3 a.m. when your ACC is on fire. You just work through the protocol.
Decision fatigue is real, and it's worse when you're sleep-deprived and your baby is suffering. Having a plan is a form of self-care.
And I think one of the most important things a parent can do in that moment is to narrate what they're doing out loud, even though the baby doesn't understand the words. I know your mouth hurts. I'm getting your cold teether. Here it is. Let's try this. I'm right here with you. The semantic content doesn't matter. The prosody, the sing-song rhythm of your voice, activates the baby's parasympathetic system through the same social engagement pathways we talked about earlier.
You're not talking to the baby to communicate information. You're talking to activate their calming system through the sound of your voice.
And it has the side benefit of calming you down, too. The act of speaking in a slow, rhythmic way forces your breathing to slow and your vocal tone to drop, which feeds back into your own nervous system.
That's a neat trick. The parent is essentially hacking their own physiology by trying to hack the baby's.
It's one of the few bidirectional interventions. You're calming yourself while calming the baby, and the baby's calming feeds back to calm you further.
Let's pull all of this together into something actionable. If you're a parent with an 11-month-old who's teething or febrile, what's the summary protocol?
First, distinguish between teething discomfort and true fever. Teething can cause mild temperature elevation up to about 100.4, but anything higher is likely infectious and warrants a different level of attention. Second, intervene at the sensory level before reaching for medication. Cold for teething, refrigerated teether, or cold washcloth to activate TRPM8 and gate pain at the spinal trigeminal nucleus. Gentle pressure and rhythmic movement to activate the descending pain inhibitory pathway. Skin-to-skin contact to activate C-tactile afferents and engage the parasympathetic nervous system. Exaggerated affect. Big facial expressions, sing-song voice, to break the still-face feedback loop. Third, optimize the sleep environment. Cool room, minimal clothing, white noise to mask sudden sounds that might trigger arousal during light sleep. And fourth, have a plan. Know your sequence of interventions before you need it, so you're not making decisions with a sleep-deprived brain while your ACC is screaming at you.
On the stranger anxiety piece, what's the practical takeaway for parents who are watching their baby suddenly reject people they used to be fine with?
Don't force it. Let the baby stay in your arms or on your lap when new people are around. Let them observe. Let them approach on their own timeline. Introduce new people in familiar contexts. Create a departure ritual if you're leaving them with a caregiver. And remember that this isn't rejection of the other person. It's a prediction error in a brain that's just learned that people continue to exist when they're out of sight. It's a cognitive milestone, not an emotional problem.
It peaks around now, right? 11 months is roughly the peak of stranger anxiety?
It varies, but the peak is typically between 10 and 18 months, with 11 months being right in the middle of the window. It coincides with the consolidation of object permanence and the development of attachment relationships. It's actually a sign of healthy cognitive development. A baby who shows no stranger anxiety at all at this age is the one you'd want to watch more closely.
That's a useful reframe. The thing that looks like a problem is actually the thing working correctly.
That's true of so much in infant development. The frequent night waking, the stranger anxiety, the intense need for physical contact, these aren't failures of parenting or problems to be solved. They're features of a developing brain that's doing exactly what it's supposed to do.
I want to look forward for a moment. The prompt asked about the inner world of an 11-month-old, and we've mapped out the sensory, social, and pain experience in some detail. But what happens next? Around 12 to 15 months, something qualitatively different starts to emerge.
Theory of mind. The ability to understand that other people have different internal states, different knowledge, different desires, different emotions from your own. At 11 months, the baby is just beginning to show precursors of this. They'll follow your gaze to see what you're looking at. They'll check your facial expression to gauge how to react. But they don't yet understand that you have a mind that's separate from theirs. That starts to emerge around 12 to 15 months, and it changes everything about the parent-child dynamic.
Because suddenly the baby can guess that you're trying to help. Before that, you're a source of comfort or discomfort, but the baby doesn't attribute intention to you. Once theory of mind starts to develop, the baby can understand that you're doing something for a reason.
That's when the first words start to come, which finally gives parents a direct window into the inner world we've been inferring. The transition from pre-verbal to verbal is arguably the most dramatic change in the parent-child relationship, and it starts right around the corner from where an 11-month-old is now.
The parent of an 11-month-old is standing at the edge of a pretty profound shift. Everything we've described, the diffuse pain, the sensory flooding, the predictive processing errors, these are the last months of a world that the baby can't describe to you. In a few months, they'll start to have the tools to tell you what's going on, even if it's just mouth hurt or no like.
That's both exciting and, I think, a little poignant. The 11-month-old inner world is this rich, complex, mostly inaccessible landscape that parents have to navigate through inference and intuition. It won't be inaccessible forever. But right now, at this moment, the only way in is through the sensory and behavioral channels we've been discussing.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1943, a Japanese soldier stationed on Sakhalin Island befriended a red fox, and for 2 years the fox would appear at his post every morning to receive a small ration of dried fish. The soldier documented the visits in a series of hand-drawn postcards he made from scrap paper, which he mailed to his sister in Hokkaido. The postcards were later discovered in a flea market in Sapporo and are now held by the Postal Museum in Tokyo.
I have so many questions about the dried fish.
The Postal Museum has a fox postcard exhibit, and we're just finding out about this now.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop, for the fact that apparently foxes on Sakhalin have better attendance records than I do. If you want more episodes, find us at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.